You serve one god, Dampere, but I have served 10,000. From Ib to Ashai, when men see my sails, they pray.
Welcome to the White Book Podcast, the original A Game of Thrones LCG podcast.
Originally founded in 2010, as Two Champs and a Chum, we decided to rebrand when the game relaunched in the second edition. A huge thank you goes out to Fantasy Flight Games and George R. R. Martin for this game and world we love, and of course to my co-hosts and you, the listeners. Please, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review on iTunes or your platform of choice, comment on our Facebook threads, or even better, support us on Patreon. We love turning that kind of support back into the community.
This is Season 12 of the White Book Podcast. It's fun to pretend I'm being dramatic while reading them. A lot of them I just can't get into. But this one spoke to me.
You should have gone to the preview chapter of Winds of Winter.
Oh yeah.
Aaron Dampere, and done that one, Will. Spice things up for our listeners.
Dang it, you're right. I should have. I really honestly should have. Things start getting real wild with Euron and that stuff.
Yeah. And it's not a spoiler because it was officially released by Martin. So, I mean, it's a spoiler if you literally want to know absolutely nothing about the book, but it's not like Martin didn't know what he was doing or didn't choose to release that information.
Yeah. I have not actually read any of the spoiler chapters that have been released, but I have at least spent enough time on the Song of Ice and Fire sub that, like, they're frequently referenced for lots of wild theories.
Yeah.
I'm pretty familiar with the gist of them.
I think you can't get involved in the in-depth of Song of Ice and Fire fandom without, you know, involving yourself in all the ancillary material that has been released by Martin.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Which I think tells our listeners what we're going to be covering today. We're back with another one of our retrospective episodes, right, Will?
We are indeed. We're on to the Kings of the Isles. Woo! I don't know why Krakens make that sound, but they do. They do, listeners. I've heard it.
They sure. Krakens exist. Yeah, we are talking about the infamous. I think it's fair to call it infamous, right?
I think so. There are several cards in this that individually earn an infamous rating at this point. Mm-hmm. So I would say the box as a whole probably does as well.
I mean, I think it has the card that is most iconic for the final third of...
The final most infamous card?
I think it's I mean, if like Tywin is the most infamous card of the early game and... like Wars to Come or Mace is the most infamous card of the middle of the game. I think at the end of the FFG era, what card do you think is the sort of like standout? Everyone knows what this card is, whether you play casually or you play competitively.
I mean, even among the many thorns in my side and the game side in this box, the one, the largest, the one that takes the cake is definitely Sea of Blood.
Yeah. Which I think it sort of answers the question. I was going to ask if you wanted to start with the Greyjoy cards or want to start with the Sea of Blood. We'll start with Sea of Blood. But I do want
to... Might as well start with the most iconic card from the box. Like, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, and half of these cards in here go in a Greyjoy Sea of Blood deck. So I'm going to just be upfront with listeners about this. I think this is the worst product printed so far. I did some prep.
The whole product.
The whole product, okay, along with individual... cards. I'm going to be extremely negative. I'm just going to tell people right now, you know, I looked over these cards at my lunch break today. I said to myself, I literally have nothing nice to say about this product. And I just want to put that on the table up front to let people sort of take that as they may. Like, I really have no good reflections on this box, both on a design and a memories on a, both the design and memory story there's, level and playtesting. There's a miserable playtesting
box that I will go to bat for. So I mentioned that to Roy earlier. We'll keep everyone in suspense for a little bit, but we'll get there.
So why don't we talk about probably the most toxic card in the, although Euron has a play for the most toxic card, but the most toxic and most iconic card in this product, which is Sea of Blood. What did you think of Sea of Blood, Will?
You know, honestly, I'm pretty sure I did not go back to listen to our original review episode, I admit, but I'm pretty sure I was down on this to even to start with, as far as it's just like, what, this totally blows up like any established kind of balance of benefit to drawback that we've had on these agendas so far, right? Like we get huge card advantage here, not only like straight like draw, which we've spilled a lot of ink, so to speak, on the podcast about draw and draw agendas being problematic, but this goes into full-on search, plus also it's econ at the same time. I'm pretty sure I was straight up incredulous that this happened.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll spill the tea all about this. We were incredulous that this card got printed as is, went through playtesting. This was like probably along with sort of Balon and Euron, a lot of ink was spilled, or I guess whatever the digital equivalent of ink was spilled, arguing about and trying to get this card into the right place. And it failed. Like, the playtesters failed in this product, I think, more than any other product on a balance level. I mean, the cards here are just like utterly ridiculous. And I include us, like we were right about some things that we gave FFG feedback about, like Sea of Blood. And we missed some things, like Scouting Vessel, that we just sort of thought would be more innocent than it ended up being. Sea of Blood is everything that is wrong with Game of Thrones as a card game. Like it hits all the bad stress points of the game, right? And then how designs in Game of Thrones work. It's extremely powerful tutor. It's leads to really, really consistent games where literally the same thing happens to you over and over and over and over again. And I think that's one of the biggest arguments against this card as like a play pattern. And I think that there's a real problem with the agendas that came out in the final third of the game with that problem. I mean, this game has that problem in general. There are too many tutors, and the fact that too many of our effects search 10 cards in your deck means that they constantly hit, which leads to, you know, the same thing happening over and over again, which is, again, something I came to really notice, you know, in 2018, but really, really, really Sea of Blood just doesn't, it doesn't, it says the quiet parts loud about some of the design problems of Game of Thrones.
So loud.
And also the fact that it just creates these snowballs, right? And one of the cool things about Thrones, and what I think drives a lot of people to the game, is the fact that you can really damage your opponent's resources in a way that you can't in other games. You know, military challenges clear your opponent's board, intrigue challenges take cards out of their hand, something that is very rare in games, and is usually priced in a very expensive and inefficient way, because it's not very fun. And then power, of course, steals the win condition from your opponent. And that's cool about Game of Thrones, but the more you put pressure on that, the less fun Thrones can be, right? And these particular, and you saw this some with Reigns, but it's really clear with Sea of Blood, right? The fact that Sea of Blood, you know, frequently led to your board being cleared on the first turn, and then you couldn't play the game for the, you were sitting there. Thankfully, it was usually pretty quick after that. But then you were just sitting around not playing Thrones for another 33 minutes in a tournament because your game was over, right? Like it, and the fact that that happened to you over and over again, the fact that almost every Sea of Blood game went the same way, if not the first turn, then the second or third turn. And then it was just the same play patterns where they got that put off and you just couldn't respond. And this game is also accentuates the problems of setup. Where, you know, if you don't set up an intrigue, a military icon, sometimes two military icons, mm-hmm. and then you aren't able to play a lot of military icons, like, you could just lose. And it could be you put military icons, you put answers, you built your deck in a way to compete with Sea of Blood to try to cancel it, and you just don't set them up and don't draw them. You could just lose. And that's not your fault.
Well, right? Yeah. Like, so much of the obvious directions to tackle that, like, the once you've built them into your deck, then you're just like, well, why aren't I just playing Sea of Blood, because I've already built for that, like, early setup, military presence and the like. Why don't I just try to leverage it myself?
Absolutely. And I think the FFG design got it in their head in the Greyjoy, and we'll talk about this, the Barrow Box with Prince, which suffers from similar but is not quite as powerful problems, is that there needed to be symmetry of there being agenda that is based on the intrigue challenge, an agenda that's based on the military challenge, and there's an agenda that's based on the power challenge. And this is a trap. And also the fact that, you know, and this is something when they redesigned it to kind of like stop you from getting the puts, kind of fixes the problem of Sea of Blood, is one of the things that's nice about Reigns is that Reigns doesn't really encourage you to do anything with the intrigue challenge. And this is something that, like, a lot of, like, Lannister Reigns decks that tried to play, like, the intrigue supporting cards alongside Reigns found that that's a trap. Like, Reigns is not about the intrigue challenge, quality intrigue challenge, right? It doesn't care about taking a card out of your hand. So, you know, it's about what the effect of the agenda does itself. But Sea of Blood synergizes so well with what the military challenge already does. The fact that you can get a put to the sword to answer your opponent's best character.
Or torch for them.
Or torch to answer their location, right? Their car hold that was stopping your renown from letting you close the game fast, right? It just synergizes too well with what the military challenge is already trying to do. And then, like, this drawback being so laughable, the fact that you could just play events when you're not in a challenge, what's the point then if you can't play events during intrigue and power challenges, right? Like, that's not really a drawback, right? Because this encourages you to play military-focused events. Mm-hmm. So why would you play Superior Claim or Tears or whatever when you just should want to play more events that trigger off the military challenge? Excuse me, or help you win military challenges. So, like, it's just not really a draw. Excuse me, it's not really a drawback.
Where you're going here, it basically this asks you to dial down on the in-game payoff for that challenge, like you said, right? Like, because so many of the military-related events amplify military by causing more board destruction. This asks you to go all in on that board destruction. And slight skip ahead to the agenda wasn't the prince that was promised, right? That's the plot.
The prince who came too late.
Yes, there we go. The power related one honestly asks you to double down on the power challenge as well, right? And soup up this one character, you know, that go all in on their renown and lots of challenges with them and that type of thing. Whereas, as you alluded to, the intrigue one does not do that. And arguably that's the most successful out of the three. I think it just shows kind of a weird narrow-sided scope late in the game here, like you said, just like rushing to kind of finish that cycle without thought to the kind of second layer of that onion, which is, wait a minute, what does that do to things if all we're doing is asking players to double down on this? We're just amplifying that effect rather than using the agenda to broaden gameplay. And that turned out to be a problem.
Absolutely. And I think the fact that the military challenge is also the most dangerous challenge to push really hard on, because it because also Thrones has like access to so many board clears, like in your plot deck, and the fact that there are board clears that you don't have to draw, that you always have access to, Valar Morghulis, Valar Dohaeris, like the big tech that got Francis and Alex to the finals of the last Worlds, was that they came up with a really great thing, is like, I see a blood deck is resilient enough that it can Valor on the first turn, and that you can, you know, your opponent can put all this effort into getting set up to resist your Sea of Blood. I'll just Valor you on the first turn, and then I will easily be able to rebuild because of some other Targaryen cards, but also, you know, winning military challenge there, you know, there's enough efficient military bodies that I'll be able to rebuild, and you, and that gives me the window to seize control of the game because I have the snowball-y agenda. Mm-hmm. And that's such a problem. Like, and repeat, and this is, you know, what we talked about Free Folk last time, right? Like, one of the reasons people hated Free Folk is it allowed players to double down on this board clear, just clear your board mentality in a way that's really hard to interact with. And that's just kind of the danger of the military challenge as something that is pushed too hard in this game. It leads to really unfun play patterns, and then combined with the consistency of those unfun play patterns in Sea of Blood, you just really have one of the most toxic cards that was printed in second edition, and it took a long time to kill this card. It wasn't even really dead until it was redesigned, and it still floated around a little bit in the few redesign tournaments that I covered. But until Hanno and friends redesigned it, it didn't go away. I mean, it won. It was a mirror match in the last Worlds, right? Like, this card.
Yeah. I don't know. I think the only other thought off the top of my head is just about the angle of how the military challenge becomes a problem. As far as destroying the board state, right? Even the intrigue challenge is mucking with card advantage, right? But there's never any gold pre-invested into those cards. Yeah, maybe you spent some on some card draw or whatever, but by sheer like mechanics of the game, you will continue to draw stuff. So one drawn card versus another is largely revenue like neutral. But for anything that has actually hit the table, you've got that investment. So the military challenge is a double whammy anytime a card is removed. Not only are you losing the simple card math, but you're also losing the simple economic math. Yeah, the tempo there. And the harder that, like the bigger move that is, the harder that snowballs. And you're just asking that to self-reinforce here. And then you're compounding that by not only are you like given this huge opportunity to like remove cards from the opponent's side of the board and lower their card count, you are lowering their economic count for ease of terms here. But then the agenda is also boosting your card count with your search and boosting your econ count with that cost reduction. So like you're playing both sides of both issues. Like that's so extreme to me when you break it down like that. Like virtually no other card plays off so many angles and compounds on itself like that.
Yeah. It's just a fundamental design mistake at all levels. And it's just like, I honestly feel insulted by the drawback of this agenda. You know, like, I'm not a firm believer that agendas, particularly with the fact that you can't play out of faction cards anymore, by default, like, need a really hard drawback. In fact, like, if they just didn't even have the drawback of here, I would feel less insulted. Like, you know, the card doesn't really, its power level barely. It's basically trinket text. To use a term that's like from, it's a game design term that's like extra text that's not necessary on a card.
Yeah.
And that wasn't for you, Will. That was for listeners who may not be familiar with
it. Oh, yeah. No. Yeah. I got
it. Like, it came up so rarely. Like, maybe hands judgments, like, were the main thing you might want to cancel, like, do an intrigue and power challenges. And it feels insulting. Like, it just feels insulting that they thought that this drawback could somehow balance all the situations that you and I have talked about so far with this card.
Absolutely agreed. I'm pretty much at the end, I think, of what else I can add to Sea of Blood discussion right now.
Do you want to talk about the plots since we're here at the bottom of the CB page?
We might as well.
Or do you want...
Because there's another card here in the plots that is in the running here for big problematic eyesores in the box, right?
Well, which one is it? We take Westeros, return to the fields, heir to the Iron Throne, like, vanquish the Unbelievers? Like, which of these plots?
Damn it, you're right.
Like,
Secrets of the Conclave, of course, right?
Which I forgot was a plot. Like, I was like, this isn't actually that horrible.
I'm actually looking at that and I'm like, that's kind of interesting. Like, tweak those stats just a little bit.
Yeah, like, make it five income, maybe. Like,
mm-hmm.
It's interesting. Like, you know, I think it's so priced out by the point, like, by just all the other busted plots that existed by this point. But, like, I was like, but I legitimately forgot that this card existed.
Oh, no, I 100% agree. I had as well. Even when we've been looking at a lot of these other stuff, things like other packs and stuff, I've looked at them and I'm like, oh, yeah, I remember that. That's terrible. But I had completely forgotten this plot existed.
Yeah, and like Stolen Message, I remember existed, but it's so useless as a plot. Like, if it was a location, it would be fine. But like, as a plot, like, so there's one turn where you pay a gold and you control your opponent's draw, but you don't have gold in your opponent's draw phase. So
yeah,
it's a weird card. Anyway,
so there's what, four plots here then that have a reasonable argument as being horrifically bad. Terra bad. There we go. That's the word I was trying to
unprint. Two of them almost certainly should have been unprinted.
I'm going to go with that's We Take Westeros and Heir to the Iron Throne. No. Return. Westeros and Return.
I mean, Heir is like almost there. How am I put this? I am a person who my Heir has missed in more critical times than I've, like, every time, like, there was the era where the Stark combo deck was legal,
mm-hmm.
and a certain person on my team was a big pusher on it. He convinced the whole Stark team that I was ahead of to play the deck. And that whole tournament and many other tournaments where I played to practice for that Thrones War, and, you know, and many tournaments I played as a Lance, like, my Heir missed 60 or 70% of the time when I needed it to hit. So like as someone whose personal Heir variance is on the lower end of the distribution, like, I can't quite put Heir in the same level as We Take Westeros and Return to the Fields. But it probably belongs, as it like should be have been unprinted.
Okay. So at this point, then let's just start at the top of the plots and just work our way down these problem ones, at least.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, We Take Westeros. I don't know, like, how much to say or, like, what to say about it, because there's not any big, like, trick here that I see. It's just that this is so wildly pushed just in pure unadulterated, like, efficiency, right? That we've kind of had a lot of middling house only, like loyal, there we go, plots. They tried to make it a thing. There at this point in the game, I think there were maybe like two that saw some reasonable play. Certainly the Martell 000 has bounced in and
out. The Martell 000 at this point was the one that saw the most play. I'm trying to think about the ones in the first cycle too. Which one?
Yeah, the Lanny one saw some play off and on, but I don't think it was at this
point. The Lanny,
it was much earlier.
The Night's Watch one stayed kind of like, should it be in Builders or not? Like the one, the original one, the 4-7-1 canceled their first challenge. Mm-hmm. Like that one stayed in and out of Builders because it was just powerful enough. The Dark ones kind of weren't anywhere. The mid-range Tyrell decks played the one from the box.
Yeah. Which honestly solid. I think is probably the most balanced of any of the house plots we saw, really.
Like that, yes, that can see it's balanced in the sense that its power level is good enough for competitive play, but it's not overpowered. Yes, you're right.
Yeah.
Because like so many of them miss. And then we get the Bera and the Targaryen ones, which saw a lot of play. So this is the beginning of, I think, a transfer. I think, are we missing one? Like, I feel like there's one that we're missing here.
I mean, the second Lanny one, we didn't really acknowledge because it's so terrible.
It's so terrible. I think we talked about it when we talked about the box.
Oh, there's the other Martell one that generates gold. Yeah. Yeah. That's a little bit of play, but
it did. It was a fun card. I liked that card.
Yeah. It's fine. But this one is just so wildly pushed. Like
it's so insanely pushed.
Literally only looking at the stats and comparing this to like other run of the mill plots, let alone the other loyal plots. 5 income, 9 initiative. I mean, claim one, okay, whatever, that's standard. And then, like, an upper middle reserve of 6. Like, all of that is, like, the upper end of normal plots. All of them. No trade-off. And then you get a huge econ boost effect. Whoo, boy.
Yeah, I think the moment when Sean Emberley started playing We Take Westeros in his Drowned God decks and pushed that on our team and just purely, I mean, sometimes incidentally a good location would be in your opponent's discard pile, which was fine. That was like upside. But the fact you would just use it for your own King's Roads is so stupid. Like, it's just this card has no balance points, right? There's no tension in this card.
Yes.
Like, what is this? Like, even other good plots ask something of you. Like, trade routes. It asks something of you that decks want to play trade routes already do, which is play a bunch of locations.
Sure. But you could have a, like, fluke draw, right?
Yeah, or like, and there were, like, mid-range decks that played trade routes because it kind of like it gave you gold in weird phases and things like that, but like it wasn't great, right? Like, you know, it wasn't great. Like, and like some decks like Stark mid-range never even really fully embraced it because it just didn't have the location base, right, to like make it worthwhile to you. I'm trying to think of like other like what's some other like standard always play, like Confiscation in many ways is like there's a minimal opportunity cost to it, but it's still only a 4-5-1-6 or 5. I can't remember if it was 5 or 6 at this point. You know, and sometimes you got the upside of getting, you know, your opponent's attachment, right? Like, that has, like, a minimal give to you. Like, it's not asking a huge amount of you, but still, like, 4 gold is the baseline, right, of plots in second edition. Mm-hmm. 5 is legitimately, like, above rate. And then, of course, this 9 initiative nonsense is like, why wouldn't you, as a Greyjoy player, ever not play this? Like, there is, like, the Grand Drowned God was a card, was a deck that didn't do anything about any other Greyjoy theme except Drowned God cards. It didn't have location destruction, didn't have attachment control, it didn't have, mid-range, like, big expensive characters. It didn't do any of the things that Greyjoy does in second edition except play Drowned God cards and use the dead pile as a zone. But it still played this. that tells you this card is too good. Like even the Targaryen one, right? That's really good. Only goes in Dothraki decks, right? Dragon Pit wasn't running it, right? The only one that's this close is the Barrow one, which even theoretically some aggressive, like the Barrow cohort decks weren't running it by the end of the game, by the end of the FFG era. So this is probably the most busted infection plot.
Yes, I think it is. I don't think there's any super strong consideration past this. It's just wildly pushed.
And the most busted, this is the most busted neutral plot. Return to the Fields, I think.
Return, yeah. Though even I was thinking about Return when you were talking about We Take Westeros and like what it asks of you. Like even with Return to the Fields, like there's some level of like what's the board state, what's my opponent mm-hmm. likely to do, sort of like a mental guessing game with Return to the Fields, which obviously was what they were trying to push with it. I think the upside just wound up still being too great, even for the theoretical downside of whiffing on, you know, hitting your opponent's valor or whatever.
Yeah, I think Return to the Fields, unlike We Take Westeros, like I think We Take Westeros, you have to fundamentally rethink and turn the knobs down a lot to make it a deck that a card that's only played in Greyjoy location destruction decks, right? Which mm-hmm. the when revealed reads as that, right? Like yeah. I newly made lord your car hold and I steal your car hold, right? You have to turn these knobs down a lot to like 4 income, 6 initiative, 1 claim, 6 reserve or something like that, right? And then Drowned God decks aren't necessarily going to run it, or you make it, or you can even
make it opponent only.
Yeah, opponent only. Like you have to adjust a lot of knobs to make yeah. this like a balanced card. Return to the Fields, I don't think there's as many knobs. Like, I think you can keep its core stat line and make it plot deck limit 1, or maybe make it reserve 6 plot deck. It has to be plot deck limit 1. Because the problem with Return to the Fields, and this is why I like Return to the Fields, because I'm bad, and I miss on my Return to the Fields a lot. But then I could always be like, oh, I have a second one.
Right.
So, all right, you didn't Valor me this turn because you read I was going to field you, but you have to Valor me next turn. So I'll just play my second Fields, and your reset does nothing. I really, really, really appreciate what Return to the Fields was trying to do.
Agreed.
Particularly in the context of this box, where I think we've talked about this before, where Greyjoy's aggressive valors can be really toxic. Toxic seems to be my word today. It can be really bad. Bad play patterns. And this card punishes an aggressive valor, right? And that's good. But the fact that it has 6 initiative, which is very high for a neutral one, and his card draw, and like even on board, like if your board's stalled out and you're at parity, you know, you can return to the field your 3 worst characters, draw 3 cards, gain 1 gold, right? So the numbers here are off, but I think that if you just adjust things slightly to that plot deck limit 1, and maybe make it 2 characters and choose between drawing a card and gaining a gold, I think you're there. But like I appreciate,
or make it not optional, make it mandatory, and then if you whiff, you have to lose your dudes. I don't know.
That's a little too much of a feel bad for me, right? Like I don't think you should have plots like that, right? Like where if you flip it, it just entirely destroys yourself, right? Like Valor, you know, if you pardon my French, you mess up Valor, you're going in there, you know, I could mess up Valor. But Return to the Fields is a kind of, but at least your opponent is also infected by you messing it up, right? And so there's some tension there and it's not entirely screwing you. But if you run into a situation where, you know, you think your opponent's going to flip Valor and they flip Secrets of the Conclave instead, and you just lose 3 characters, like that's just not fun. Like, that's not good. That's not good gameplay. At least to me.
I mean, yeah, no, I can see the argument. I was just spitballing, random different dials that could be turned.
Maybe at least one could be fine. Like, you at least have to sacrifice one. You know, like, it could be templated somewhere like a Forced March, where, you know, one always happens, mm-hmm. but then right. you can choose to do it additional times. That might be
interesting.
That could be interesting. So there's a little bit of a cost to you if you mess it up, but it's not like losing one character, but you still draw a card, right?
Right.
Is not the end of the world. But like being like, you lose three characters, sure, you draw cards, but gain gold, but your board is gone. It's like when your opponent's board is just like, oh, cool, yeah, I played Trade Routes.
It's right. Like,
oh, okay. Or I play, we take Westeros, and, you know, that kind of thing. How about air, Will? I think you hate air more than I do, so why don't you come for it?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I hate air all that bad, other than what wound up kind of cropping up around it. I guess it's another one, even like Return to the Fields, where like I kind of see where it was going, and I agree with the spirit of the card. I like the idea. I just feel that how it shook out was too much. And it just wound up leading to too much consistency and certainty on these type of, I mean, mainly the combo-y type of Lady Dex, that you could land that, and then it was self-feeding additional potential triggers. And it just, I don't know, it kind of comes back to what we're saying about Search in Thrones so often being a sword with no hilt, shall we say. And you may like the idea, but it may be bad in the end. And yeah, it's just Nedley, but it wound up not being good for the game.
I mean, I don't think it's Nedley because it doesn't, like, require you to sacrifice. Like, theoretically, you should sacrifice a higher-cost character to get a lower-cost Lord or Lady, right? Because it's heir to the Iron Throne.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah. Like, I mean, like, I accept that there's some, like, granularity of Nedliness that I have to sacrifice because it just becomes unplayable at that point.
I guess.
How many attachments would we have in the game that would say, like, play on Jaime Lannister only, or, you know, whatever the equivalent might be?
I feel like this card fails because on a Nedley level, because it, like, it does, like, sacrifice, like, putting your heir into play and then having to sacrifice your Lord Lady doesn't feel right. Like, I feel like if it was, like, Marjorie's effect,
After they die, go get one.
Like,
yeah.
I think that would have been cooler and more Nedley, and also give your opponent more of a, like, play around kind of thing than
this. You would
have
to find that avenue to get them killed. Yeah, I could dig that.
I think everything about this card, like, while I enjoyed the theory of, even though I, like, of all the combo decks that I played or in Thrones, this is the one that I had the least success with and didn't, but I appreciated on a design level, like, what that deck was doing. And I find that kind of gameplay fun. This card itself, I think it just has so many sour points, right? It misses a lot. And the fact that it also, like, turning a Rickon into a fast Eddie is just, like, it's fun for me, but, like, turn one heirs that turned the Rickon or the Sansa or the Arya into into Wyman, right? Or into Fast Eddie or into Kat was just really obnoxious. And the fact that this is also another card that has weird rules interactions that get ruled inconsistently at different tournaments. Like, Will, if you pull a dupe, do you sacrifice anything?
You do not, right?
I believe that is what it is.
Yeah.
But I've had it called, and I've thought at different times it does different things. Like, it's... Yeah, this card is just a mess. I think it's... And it's dangerous design space, and we'll see this again also with the one we mentioned earlier, the Prince Who Came Too Late,
right,
which is an even more obnoxious version of this card, which at the very least they acknowledged that the stats of that plot are so bad that, like, you really do have to think twice about putting that card in your deck.
It's kind of the attempt at a fixed heir to the Iron Throne, I think, right? They really tweak the stats and the timing to try to mitigate a lot of the issues the heir has.
Yeah, but I think if this was like 3 gold, I think it would have been better.
Though when you bring up gold, that is worth noting that we didn't quite spell this out before. This kind of has the same issue of Sea of Blood, right? We're getting search, even if it's more limited search, but we're getting search and economic boost all in one package.
Right. I mean, if the argument that was made is, well, sometimes you turn your Arya into a Sansa. Well, there's no economic gain there. Kind of stuff. So, you know.
And I suppose with Sea of Blood, on turn one, you have to pay full price. So.
No, you don't. You always get one.
Oh, dang it. You're right.
Trust me, Will. There's times I've lost the game because I was like, oh, well, you know, they only have 1 gold. Yeah. Not 2. And I'm like, oh, wait. But.
Curses. I'm resorting for a moment to old reaction orders or something. I don't know. Oh. Play it off somehow to my poor memory.
I mean, doubling back, like if Sea of Blood had Kohor's timing, right, where you couldn't use the event in the challenge you won, that's another thing. That's another knob they could have turned on the toxic card. All right, Vanquish, which is probably the lowest offender here, but it's still a pretty big offender. What do you think about this card?
I guess, I mean, it's another one where it's kind of a neat idea. Like I love tribal stuff, right? And I like things that push that, but this wound up in some weird space where it was like, well, we want to enable tribal stuff. We just don't want to pick which tribe, but we want to try to make it really playable. So like one of the general kind of balancing downsides to most tribal stuff, or, you know, all in on a trait, whatever, clansmen, wildlings, that sort of thing in Game of Thrones, is that you have to like narrow in on that one particular scope and make a trade-off of what you're losing. But by Vanquish being such a generic, oh, pick any tribe, literally any of them to work this with, you lose a lot of that trade-off. And suddenly now you mostly just have a plot with incredibly push stats. Like the game up until this point has, and especially when you look at, say, the first year of the game, you could tell they were being very careful with 2 claim.
And for even well into the like wars era, they were being very cautious with 2 claim plus.
And this throws that caution to the wind. And
initiative as well. Like,
yes. Well, and that's one of the particular dials versus 2 claim that had really been fiddled with, I think, from long lessons in first ed, right? That if 2 claim gets to go first, that is a huge deciding factor because of, well, all the things we've said even earlier this episode in regards to how the challenge tempo works out, like card and econ tempo. And so you wind up with, you know, like all these 2 claim winner plots that are like 2 initiative, so that virtually anything beats them and gets a chance to do something before getting clobbered. Because while 2 claim exists, I will go to my grave saying that the game is balanced around the assumption that virtually all challenges are 1 claim.
Mm-hmm.
And while 2 exists and it's a neat kind of spice, kind of layer to add, you can't ever let it get to the point where it is common or all the other scaffolding starts to break down. And yes. Vanquish has the type of stats to do that.
And I agree. And I think the problem, I think, I have no, where I disagree with you, because I agree with a lot of what you say. There's 2 things I disagree with you about. First, is I don't mind neutral trait push, right? Like, say they printed a card that was like a 2-cost location that said, pick a trait. All characters with that trait get +1 strength, right? Because it lets you, like, push, like, small trait. So if someone wants to build, like, a House Mormont deck, right? They can now do that, and they get this benefit from playing House Mormont. You see what I'm saying? But if you try to, because if you try to print a card that pushes each trait, like, you, eats up design space really quickly.
The difference, or like the fine kind of joining segment between those, is you picked an example for your hypothetical that is comparatively, I think, low impact.
And I agree.
I think that's what you have to do if you're making kind of generic, yeah, pick a tribe, any tribe type of effects. Vanquish, I think its problem was it was pick a tribe, any tribe, and it was pushed.
Well, let's add additional right to my example.
Sure.
2 gold, +2 strength, +1 strength on the trait you named, you know, action. Look at the top card of your deck. If it's the, you know, reveal the top card of your deck. If it is of the named trait, you may play that card as if it was in your hand or something like that, right? You know, I'm basically, there's a current Magic card that exists that's kind of like this. And that's why I'm going off of it, right? Like, that's more pushed, right? Or you, even if we make it, it's not even an action, right? You can always look at the top card of your deck, and if it is of a character of that trait, you can marshal it, right? Like, that's more powerful and pushed, right? And it pushes, but it means that you can now build any trait you want. You want to build a House Frey deck? You can now build a House Frey deck, and you have this neutral thing. And FFG doesn't need to print all these cards that support these things, right?
Sure.
The problem with Vanquish, to me, is it only pushes one style of trait decks, which is aggressive trait decks, right? Like, Wildlings, this is their dream card. Dothraki, this is their dream card, right? And that's where you most consistently saw Vanquish. Like, you saw some Drowned God decks play this, you know, as a way to kill a character sometimes, or just because they wanted the 2-claim as a closer if it was forced to play a fair game. And that's maybe where it was, like, marginally acceptable, but the places where it was most obnoxious was those aggressive trait-based decks. And the fact that this card only pushed that one style is where I think it really goes sideways. I think it pushes it too hard as well. Like, 582 is just busted. And it allows you to open on a 2-claim plot, mm-hmm. and open on a 2-claim plot that lets you play an impactful character or characters is a problem.
And lets you still keep stuff in hand at 5 reserve.
At 5 reserve. Yeah, is a problem as well. But I think that the fundamental design argument I have against this is that it's only pushes one type of trait-based deck. Right? If you want to play a Maester's deck, you can't play Vanquish the Unbelievers.
I mean, and a type that it pushes, that the, like, straight tribal stuff, so to speak, the specific tribal stuff in those tribes is already also pushed, right? Like, mm-hmm. in your examples, if this was Frey or Mormont or, heck, probably even Clansmen or, like, dozens of other traits and their type of game
House
plan.
House Aaron.
Like, House Aaron, Maester, like, their card pool of the cards actually with that trait had not been pushed to the level that Wildlings and Dothraki become. And then, as you said, this dovetails with their strategies. So now they're getting doubly pushed because they also get the generic pushed card.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And I wish that they had instead looked at more sort of neutrally card advantage-y ways that could push a variety of traits, if you're going to go to this design space, versus this, like, again, only punch you in the face aggressive decks. I don't want to double down specifically, though, about what you said about 2-claim plots.
Sure.
That's something I don't think we've talked a lot in this series, so now it could be the time of a fundamental good tension point in Thrones, right? Like, 2-claim mm-hmm. plots are fun as long as they are occasional.
Yeah.
And this, again, goes back to reasons why people didn't like the Wildlings deck. The reason why the Wildlings deck was so good against Greyjoy midrange strategies was that 2-claim plots were a thing that was really hard for those decks to deal with, because like turn, particularly if you did two claim military challenges in a turn, right? You know, that eats up all your saves and leaves you vulnerable to resets or coming for a second one, right? Where like a pot deck, like where Thrones is sometimes in a good space is, you know, if you need to have a two claim plot as your closer, right? So where maybe a lot, some mid-range decks are running 1-2 claim plot as that plot that like gives them reach, right? Particularly you saw this a lot with Lannister at its high point, because Lannister didn't have a huge amount of renown and sometimes had trouble like with reach. Like it could take control of the board, but was the slowest mid-range deck that once it had taken control of the board to win the game. And that could give your opponent an opportunity like a Greyjoy or a Tyrell player or a Stark player who have a bit more renown and a bit more like Rob can really take over a game if he gets going, could to catch back up. So they would run a two-claim plot in the Mirando years to sort of like give them that oomph. Like that's a good place for two-claim plots. Mm-hmm. But when decks are entirely based around that, then it gets really problematic and pushes all the tension points of the game in a really bad way. Because I want to double down to my earlier point. Thrones, and this is something actually Eric Lang kind of hinted at, if you go and listen to the interview he did for Think Like the Game Designer, where he kind of like says he really loves Thrones, but there's some decisions that he would make in core design of this game that he would not make now 20 years later, maybe even longer than that, right? Is it 20 years?
Almost 19, almost. I think it dropped in 01. It dropped, sorry, not in 01, it dropped in 02.
Okay, so what I was just shy of 20 years.
Yeah,
next year will be the 20th anniversary, right? Mm-hmm. And this game does sometimes feel like a game system that is 20 years old, even with the updates for second edition. It's like kind of some of the ways it operates. And that sort of tension of the ways in which you mess with your opponent's tempo and you mess with your opponent's cards and in ways that are hard for your opponent to interact with is one of the draws of Thrones. But the more you push it, the more it becomes, oh wait, there's a reason why Hearthstone, Magic, most other modern card games don't do things like the intrigue challenge or even the military challenge, because it can be a really unfun and uninteractive experience if it gets pushed too hard.
Ooh. I'm going to let that one ride for the moment, because I think delving too hard into like broader game design theory, where I think I maybe disagree a little bit here, is going to completely blow up the scope of this episode. And frankly, we've already spent nearly an hour on only the agenda and the plots.
Well,
out of this box. At this point, I'm afraid we're going to have to make the Greyjoy box a two-part retrospective.
I don't have a huge amount to say about the Greyjoy cards, other than to say my word of the day, toxic.
Sure.
Like these cards aren't fun. Like,
even ones that looked fun at first glance, like once the broader card pool player pool got to tinker with them, we realized we're a problem. Like Balin Greyjoy, I think at first glance, oh, this is cool and like weird and interesting. And then the instant people are like, yeah, but what if you do something like use Vince to kill the character you just stole? And you're like, fudge, that is super NPE, never mind. Or at least that was my reaction.
Yeah, I mean, I think you literally had that on the show with Glazer and I when we
maybe
like we hated this card so much in playtesting and tried to get it changed so much. First off, it's such a break in Greyjoy color pie. Like Greyjoy steals locations.
Mm-hmm.
Since when did it get this, and attachments as a secondary theme? But primarily attachments, primary locations, secondarily attachments. When does it get to steal characters? Like,
and why Balin? I could at least maybe see an argument with Euron, maybe or like Theon dressing you into his crew. Yeah, or Theon, but Balin?
I guess that's what the thematic spaces they're trying to get at. Or even Victarion, right? Because Victarion steals, you know, people, and when he's on his ship to Dany, right? Like they take ships and stuff. Excuse me. But this card is horrible design. Like all three of these cards, like the three marquee cards, when you like if you open a pack, the top three cards, Balon, Euron, and Asha, are all extremely unfun cards. The fun is entirely on one side.
Yeah. And they are super pushed and like eye-catching for that as fan, but that doesn't mean good for the game.
No, and they're also really uninteractive experiences, right? Like, I play Balon, I steal your best character. Even then, I get to use your best character out of the discard pile. I get to do something cool with it. Then it goes under your deck. Cool. Or I kill it with Vince. Mm-hmm. Oh, uncool. All right. Euron gets 11 gold in value and is a tricon with Intimidate. And then, you know, Silence is a card that just starts taking over the game, particularly when you paid 0 gold for it. Like... Yeah. And this is another design that Glazer and our playtesting group argued against. 11 gold of value from a single card. And like,
I mean, it's econ and search card value. Like, that seems to be a recurring theme with multiple problematic cards, toxic cards, to steal Roy's word for a moment, in this same box. It's how can we really turn the two most problematic dials in card games up to 11 on the same card?
And then, like, Silence is such a terrible design because, like, at 4 gold, Silence seemed... Like, if you just had to draw and play Silence, it wouldn't be that bad. But the fact that it most frequently comes into play and that Euron searches it out from every zone except for being in play is, like... really obnoxious, but the fact that it stands a character that has Intimidate, there's a point that was made in one of the Thrones groups, and I don't remember who made it, and I apologize, but they made a really good point about Intimidate. Intimidate is a keyword you really need to be careful with, and Euron really shows why, because if you get to multiply Intimidate your, and this is something that was seen actually with Greyjoy, and Euron is just another piece of evidence. Like, multiple uses of an Intimidate character in one turn is just not fun. Right? And, like, so you have this... Balon is obnoxious to play against and hard to interact with. Euron provides all this tempo, all this value, card advantage. And then, seemingly, Asha is not... Like, you read Asha, and you're like, yeah, that's not so bad, right? Until a couple of things that you don't, that you might forget, unless you just really think about the Greyjoy card pool. Everything is Ironborn in Greyjoy. Like, everything. It's just like that trait is stapled on to basically every useful Greyjoy card, including all, let's see, how long does it take before we get to a non-Ironborn character?
Oh, gosh.
Okay, actually, the Knight is the next card. Yeah, all right.
Yeah.
But Drowngard, Ironborn, Captain. Okay, cool. All right. Well, my point is, oh, but here's an Ironborn. Ironborn, Maester, Ironborn, Drowngard. So it's there a lot, but at least most of the characters you
it's
want.
It's almost every other character this box, let alone the rest of the Greyjoy.
Let's say 45% in this box, but much less the broader Greyjoy card pool. Almost all the playable Greyjoy characters, particularly that go in a mid-range deck, are Ironborn.
If they're not part of the narrow Drowngard deck, they're almost certainly Ironborn.
The problem with stealth is like Intimidate. That small amounts of stealth are cool, but when your opponent's entire board has stealth, and suddenly they just go unopposed challenge, unopposed challenge, unopposed challenge, it just isn't fun anymore, right? Like, there was, like, I remember once playing a game at Thrones War where my opponent played this Asha, and I was like, oh, that's not so bad. And then I look at their board, and I said, every single one of their characters has stealth. They have about 7 or 8 characters. I have about 7 or 8 characters. This board is that interesting parody, but now it's not anymore. Because they're just going to go unopposed, unopposed, unopposed. You know, blow up a location, get this, do this. I'll get all their triggers. And there's not a lot I can do. Because they have multiple instances of stealth on each challenge icon. Mm-hmm. It's not, okay, which is their 1 or 2 stealth characters are they going to use to get this unopposed challenge they want through? It's like, no, they can just get all their challenges. And so Asha is, she's also a card that continues to hammer home one of the themes that we've talked a lot about, which is the design trap that Nate and Danny and Damon, everyone who's designed for this game, has done, which is the, oh, there's a busted version of this cool, unique character, so it doesn't matter how good of a version we print otherwise, right? Euron is another example of this as well. Balon is another example. Like, these three, it's just like, oh, yeah, both the core and Seven Cross Balon are really good. Doesn't matter what we do for the new Balon. Why would someone not want to play those two cards? Seven Cross Euron is one of the most busted cards in the core set. It's seen play all the way to the point in which this Euron is printed. Of course it's not going to get printed. Seven Cost Asha is a value engine.
Mm-hmm.
Why wouldn't you play her over this six cost card? What? Pillage? Pfft, who cares about that? But that's a trap. And these cards are just frustrating. And it doesn't get better from there. Like, that's the other thing. Like, this is the first three cards. These are the marquee cards. And, you know, it doesn't get better from there.
I mean, there's some other perfectly normal, like the knight, right? Like, this, he is, I think, a perfectly normal, run-of-the-mill, B-ish, mid-rangey Greyjoy card that kind of rewards some careful play and choices, and it frankly he forces you into the opposite problem of stealth from what you were saying with Asha. Like, there are perfectly reasonable Greyjoy cards in the box, well, not just Greyjoy, but cards in general in the box that point towards some interesting play patterns.
How many of them saw play though, particularly of Greyjoy?
I mean, the knight did he?
Like, I mean that really seriously. Is there a way to like search out how frequently a card appeared on Thrones DB? Like, I honestly don't remember ever playing.
I definitely played him, but I do admit some of that may be my memory skewing things because of Melee. He, I do admit, is kind of a slam dunk 1X in any Melee deck featuring Greyjoy.
Right. Or Bannered Kraken, right? Because he's non-loyal and doesn't require any Greyjoy themes.
Right.
And in fact, he could be even good, you know. The knight in other factions has, you know, the trait, the knight has good synergy for the knight in other factions.
Also true.
Yeah, but,
I mean, because I was playing him in my Tyrell Kraken. Or no, it was Kraken Rose, my bad. Or right. Dang it. Greyjoy Rose. Man, it gets tough trying to flip the banners when I'm saying that.
Yeah, like, and Carl the Maid, like, that's another card that's like perfectly unobjectionable.
Even Andric, like, he's kind of pushed, but he's kind of an interesting take on that kind of location destruction and dovetailing it with pillage. Like, I can take that. It's just the whole picture.
Yeah, he's like trying to fix the mountain, right? Like, that's kind of what he's like, a fixed mountain, but he's still not that great, like, as a card. And he saw some play. Like, he definitely saw some play.
Yeah. But, like, I mean, he definitely saw play in Sea of Blood, right?
Yeah, he definitely did. Like, but let's look at some of the other cards. Aaron Damphair, not a positive addition from, like, I love Aaron. Don't get me wrong. He is one of my favorite cards in the box. On a taking a step back and looking objectively, not a good addition to the Greyjoy card pool from a level of good play patterns. Mirror, not a good addition to the Greyjoy card pool. All right, at all, right? Old Gray Gull, not a good addition to the Greyjoy card pool. Priest of Oldwick, okay.
I mean, yeah.
Drowned Prophet is the one I'm really thinking of. Drowned Prophet,
yeah,
not a good addition. Search. Excuse me, right? I like, even Eager Deckhand.
I figured you were gonna throw him under that bus, or her. I think in
her, yeah,
art it's here. One,
excellent decision. Like, I like when they take the opportunity to use non-unique characters to put female representation in the game's art. I think it's a really good decision. Eager Deckhand, she's just a card that. Mm-mm. And also, like, oddly, Orcmont Reaver is a really obnoxious card.
Orcmont Reaver, really, man, that is a card I tried to defend. I'm sure on this podcast, and you guys were like, no, this is absolute trash.
How do I put this? It is trash. It's the kind of card that's trash, but when it becomes a diamond in that trash, like, you don't want it. Like, it, you, like, a cheap, a 2-for-1 stealth is obnoxious. Yeah, again, now let's see. Silence, we've already talked about. Great Wick, okay, that's a miss. Golden Storm and Maiden's Bane, gigantic mistake designs. The Stand, the fact you could do them multiple times, bad design, repetitive. All right, Red Rain, Fleet Captain, whatever. Then we get into the events. No one cares about the events.
You skipped Scouting Vessel, I think.
Oh, right. Oh, and Scouting Vessel.
I mean, that one is largely due to rules quirks, right?
I think it's like, also like, Pillage is like this weird thing where it's like not, like, I love Mill. Like,
but it's just not good until it is.
It is not, but
it's like, not usually a middle ground.
There's not a, but like Pillage and Thrones is not really about milling your opponent out. That means for anybody who doesn't know at this point, but it's you trying to make your opponent's deck empty so they lose the game. I think milling your opponent so they lose is a cool alternate win condition, but like Pillage cards aren't really those kind of cards. They instead want to queue off your opponent. Like when your opponent discards certain cards. And I tend to find those to be very obnoxious designs because they're very like random and very swingy in their randomness. I mean, the biggest example of this, of course, is the Mountain. But another big one is Euron, right? The Corset Euron. Like there's just like a lot of randomness that's just like not fun. Like where is the fun in that in the core Euron's design? And particularly when you combine it with Scouting Vessel, like, oh. Right? Like, not only are the rules quirks really bad with this card, but, like, the just additional opportunities to do the obnoxious things with Pillage is just bad design space. I will say in playtesting, most playtesters weren't really clear on what the rules were of this card. So, like, it should have been worded differently to avoid some of the issues that it had. But yeah, so Scouting Vessel is another big mistake. So again, like there's like a 60% like just bad, overpowered, uninteractive designs in this box for the gray cards, like or the blue cards, whatever color Greyjoy is. This might show some slight color blindness on my end, but
well, I've just been looking at the whole giant list. They're blue, yeah.
They're all right, blue. Yeah, that's kind of like what I have to say about these cards. Like they're just bad. Like this, they're like so many of them are at best the fun is one-sided and promote really bad play patterns that are going to dominate the game from sort of the mace restriction up to the summer of Greyjoy Prince that was promised. Where were you at that Gen Con, Will, that Mellucci won?
Crud, there was one in second edition I missed. I feel like it might have been that one.
But, like, maybe I can go back real quick and look at Jousting Pavilion. But if I remember correctly, Greyjoy was such an insane percentage of the meta.
Or, no, I think I was at that one. Wait a minute, when did second ed launch? I know I was at the launch, but maybe I missed the one after that. It was the year we got married was the year I had to miss Gen Con. So I think I was there for this one.
Right. Like if we look like up to the point in which Mellucci won Gen Con, that like summer of Greyjoy, where it felt like literally every tournament was won by Greyjoy. Like if you look at that Gen Con, 32% of the field was Greyjoy. The closest competitor was 16% with Stark. All right, and 9% with Tyrell. All right, and then everything sort of falls.
Below,
right, like that's how dominant this box. Like, this box really did fundamentally change second edition, and it doesn't even have to do with Greyjoy because there's also the Sea of Blood. But I think that it continued to underwrite the cards in this box continued to underwrite Greyjoy's success up to the end of the game. But certainly, it took multiple restrictions to make. Put Greyjoy in line with other factions. And it's frustrating. Like I just, yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what else to add on that front. I'm thinking about transitioning us to the rest of the houses, because there's at least one gem out of this, right?
There's one bad card, should be unprinted card in here.
That's probably the one I just called a gem.
Is it Desert Raider?
Yeah.
Oh my God, Will.
No. I mean gem as far as worth like talking about.
Oh, right.
It stands out.
Oh, yeah.
Like
definitely.
I personally love it. Well, I mean, obviously I do when I'm playing it. But it effectively suffered from the same problems that it had in first edition, right? Where it was just wildly efficient, repeatable control, and then somehow kind of doubled down on that in this edition by still being as cheap, which kind of threw out the cost curve, right? Two cost in second ed is a different thing than two cost in first ed. And then being non-loyal so that it could be, you know, yes, abused by things like Greyjoy.
Yes, Greyjoy. I mean, that's the big thing. I think one of the things that we pushed in playtesting was bare minimum that this should be a loyal card. And, you know, they stuck to the design principle that Nate set out with the Stark box, that all of these out-of-faction cards have to be non-loyal. This is a huge mistake that they make. There's several designs that are more palpable if they're loyal and they don't show up a bunch of weird places, like Greyjoy Sun. If they're loyal, like the example, of course, is Red Keep, right? Why is Red Keep not loyal, right?
Yeah. Well, because it was in that
in the Targaryen
house slot. Yeah.
Yep. And the fact that what's weird is you would think that the drawback of placing one power on an opponent's character is worse than prize one, but actually it's much better than prize one, right? And because characters are more vulnerable than your opponent's faction card, the fact that Desert Raider encourages you to run resets, like the tension points are all off in this card. And so the fact that it is like such an obnoxious Martell control card, but then of course is such a good a Drown God card, even though it doesn't have the Drown God trait, is just bad. Like this card is, I enjoy playing it as
what
well.
Are you talking about? It has the Raider trait. That's why it was played in Greyjoy for the Raider decks.
Right, of course, for the Raider decks. Right, and it's like supposed to be an answer to Greyjoy. This card, again, this
how
card
is it an answer to Greyjoy where it's not like addressing their most like potent icon? Ugh.
Well, yeah, I mean, like one of the weird things about Greyjoy is that like theoretically power challenges are supposed to be one of their things. They have a lot of power icons, right? They have a whole sub theme, Drown God, that is like our power monocons.
Mm-hmm.
But like it never quite gets there, right? I mean, like, of course, one of the secrets of Thrones is that factions that get given the power challenge as their thematic core tend to suffer. I mean, Barra is the big one. I mean, that has a lot to do with like how the power challenge operates, right? But
it doesn't affect board state.
Correct.
Which is why military winds up overshadowing power in regards to Greyjoy, because the power challenge does not help them trigger all of this sweet unopposed stuff. On the other hand, killing things and reducing the opponent's board makes it less likely they can defend. So now all of those abilities are more active.
Right. And the power challenge also like is best when your opponent's a little ahead. And frequently you don't want your opponent to like have a lot of power, right? Like, so in fact, if you are ahead, then doing power challenges become less valuable.
Right.
Particularly, you know, like winning a power challenge when your opponent has no power, if it's opposed, doesn't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you have renown yourself, right? Or you have a bunch of things that trigger off it. But that's still like a weird, it's like a tension that has like across the CCG, the first edition and second edition, it's a tension that they never really solved.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk more about that when we get to the Barra box. But yeah, this card, it falls a little in the Vince category of being like a really iconic card, but I think it's in many ways, I think it's worse than Vince. Because at the very least, it was only Greyjoy decks that Vince was in. And Desert Raider showed up in obvious places, like Greyjoy Sun, but also occasionally showed up in other weird places. And just like, no, Desert Raider. No.
Just no.
And then there's just like a lot of garbage. Like the Barra cards don't really land. The Lannister cards don't land. The Night's Watch cards are terrible. The Tyrell cards are really bad. One of the two Stark cards and one of the two Targaryen cards are bad. So, yeah. Like, if you are a person who doesn't care about Greyjoy cards and you don't care about orange cards, hopefully you want to play Stark Control because Carhold's sweet. Or you want to play Koho. You want to play Dothraki because Koho, however you say his name, is relatively Koholo? Sweet. Koholo. Like, I find him obnoxious. You know, he's a good card in those decks. So, yeah.
I mean,
he doesn't offer a lot to you.
We did get the one card that I was going to wholeheartedly defend in this box, and we haven't even talked about him yet.
Who is it going to be?
Gunthor, son of Gurn. Just very respectable, you know, like, marshaling him versus ambushing him is actually, like, a reasonable kind of game state trade-off. Like, he's not super strong, but it is an ability that's worth triggering. He plays into a couple different Lannister themes without, like, being wildly pushed. Like, this is just the sort of Thrones card that I really, really would have wanted more of.
I mean, he even could have been a three Marshall, three Ambush. Like,
he could, but then there's not as much tension on marshaling versus ambush. Like,
yeah,
I that there's something to weigh.
I think he ended up getting marshaled a lot more than ambushed because
he probably did. Yes,
that was my experience playing. I played Lannister Valyrian Steel at Throne Soberfest 2019, and he has in my deck, and he was a good card in the deck. But that was frequently like kind of like it's just like saving that one gold when I could save it for. You know, Valyrian Steel card or an event was much better than you just sort of like play him, right? Like, I think Lannister was in a point where it can afford to sort of like have no trade like that. I feel like if he was printed in cycle one, he should definitely be where he is, right? You know what I mean? Like, he's at a cycle one Lannister good card level where I think Lannister is at a point where you could afford to give Lannister a little bit better rate. That's my only complaint about him, but I think he is a good design. He almost could afford to be a little bit better. Like, his numbers could be tweaked just a little bit more. But I do agree. I mean, my card of these that stands out is Carhold. Like, I don't like Carhold. I don't like playing Carhold decks. But I think Carhold is one of the best escape valves that was printed in second edition. It's sort of ability to turn off a lot of combo decks was useful, right? Like, it really did allow particularly Martell Wolf, but to a lesser extent, some Stark control decks or Stark mid-range decks to have some additional space and to force. It's like a really good Stark no fun card because it doesn't like stop your opponent from doing anything, right? You could still do all three of your challenges.
Unless you're playing melee.
That's true. I don't think about melee. It
kind of broke that format, so I've got a little bit of a grudge against it for that.
That's fair, Will. Like, I honestly I've never played in a melee tournament where this card was legal. I guess I played in Worlds 2018, so maybe this was legal, but I didn't run into anyone playing Carhold. As a joust card, I think it's good because it like just doesn't stop. Like, you just have to win challenges fairly. And a lot of the cards it's like really stopping are pretty degenerate. You know, Drown God, even Mace, cat, things like that. So, like, I think this was a good escape valve, and it's like the two cost spot is good, so it's not like zero opportunity cost if it was like one gold. So, like, it's a two cost location that kind of like does nothing if your opponent is not really like relying on power, like relying on renown. But so there's some opportunity cost and there's some play around. Like, if you have a few winter plots in your deck, you can, you know, get this effect turned off. So there's some really good tensions as an answer card compared to like no surprises or things, or even what's the ambush stopping card?
Barring the Gates?
No.
It also stops a lot of other stuff.
The Stark one, the 4/4.
The army, crud, I can't think of
the name is escaping me, but like that card, yeah. I also think it was a good escape valve, but it was a little obnoxious because it stopped your opponent from playing the game sometimes. The car hold doesn't really do that unless they're trying to do something degenerate. So while you'll never see me play a car hold deck, I appreciate its existence in the game.
Okay. I mean, I can acknowledge that, I suppose.
I'm sorry it broke Melee, Will.
Oh, man. I mean, that's a whole different topic for me to go down, but I still say one of the biggest problems with that format is just that it was never like actively planned and accounted for. And then at the company level, which then allowed players to abuse that lack of attention. But
yeah, definitely. I mean, definitely being playtesting, some cards were considered and redesigned because of Melee. There were some people in playtesting that really enjoyed Melee, and they when they saw problems, they would note it. It definitely wasn't like actively played. Do you know what I mean? Like,
right.
Even the people who are most aggressive in playtesting about like getting games in, we're not doing Melee games. But there were definitely people saying, hey, this is busted in Melee, we need to fix it. The big Cersei, the 7-cost Cersei is an example of that. She was redesigned a little bit to make her more balanced in Melee.
Okay.
That's the one that jumps in my mind first. But if someone missed it, right, like, or just didn't think about it, there was no chance it would get caught at some point in the process, unless FFG was internally testing Melee. And I heard some, no, not even heard rumors. Nate, when he came on for the last time, Nate was on the show, he talked about the only time he plays Melee is when they played Melee in the building. The only time he played Thrones in second edition was when they played Melee in the building. So
which does not specify how often that is.
That's fair. I think Melee's biggest problem was, I feel like they could have just been more aggressive with the restricted list in Melee because it was seldom played and it was its own.
That has to go to point toward that lack of attention, right? Like,
yeah.
Because they weren't paying that level of attention to be more aggressive with that, people had the room to abuse those cards more because they weren't restricted.
Right, and a lot of those were Greyjoy, right? With Corpse Link, right, was the big one.
yeah, that was certainly one direction. Yep.
Right. I think I'm out of things now to say about this set. I mean, because the neutral cards do not speak to me.
Yeah,
I guess Starry Sept's the standout one.
Yeah, I mean, and Starry Sept, I don't think is like a problem card. I think it's a cool, interesting, flexible one. Like, by and large, my memories of play with Starry Sept or with it on a board revolved around interesting plays. I mean, sure, it could just be a power gain card.
Yeah, that's how I mostly saw it. Like,
yeah, but even at that, a like 3-cost power gain location, like, that never was like a game breaking to me. So that's probably why the main memories were interesting kind of negotiations and thoughts back and forth. Again, mainly Melee, about like, hey, you know, what can be blanked? Who can afford to give power to who? You know, how can we use this to control the table without like giving too much of a power flow one way or another? Like, It did a lot of cool things in that context.
I feel like, as a melee player, you should hate this card. This is the most ultimate king maker card that exists ever.
It is possible. And I am a little bit flabbergasted that I never ran into that, but I never did.
I mean, because like, I'm just imagining DC at their high point. Being like, oh, Corey's at 13 power and there's two DC guys.
Yeah.
Their starry steps go on Corey's character. Boom.
Yeah.
Game over. Right. Like, I was on the receiving end of some starry steps that got out of control as power claim things. So I don't have as much. And I also played against like some of the, we'll talk next time. It's a good transition to the next one. When Sparrows enters the Joust meta, and this is a great place to put your Sparrows power, that's where it gets a little obnoxious. I'm not in love with this card, but I definitely sort of can see some of the interesting plays about it. And there definitely were some cool plays that I saw with this card. But I also just sometimes lost to it because it was on both ends of a neutral power gain card that later synergized really well with Sparrows. So
that's a thing that could happen.
It's definitely a thing that can happen.
That's pretty much the end of things for me.
Overall, what do you think is your big assessment of this box?
Is it bold enough to call this box a failure? I feel like failure gives the connotation of falling short of the goal, but this one I think overshoots so hard that I don't think the product from a gameplay perspective was successful. I mean, I'm sure it was from a sales perspective, right? Like you had to get in on this to play competitively.
And Greyjoy is a popular faction.
For some reason.
It always was. How am I put this? This is the R-rated version. This box is a fuck up, is what this is. Like, I mean, and some of this is going to be biases. Like some people would probably say our beloved Tyrell box is more of a fuck up. But I don't think so, because Sea of Blood, I think, is worse than Worst to Come. And I think this box fails the game on multiple levels. Its marquee cards, both neutral and Greyjoy, are extremely, to end the episode with my word of the day, toxic. Like, this box was toxic. It gave us Sea of Blood. It gave us Greyjoy Sea of Blood. It gave us Greyjoy Euron-based decks. The Euron Warship combo, Warship Victarion combo, sort of ruled Greyjoy for a long time. It gave Drown God additional consistency. It created this Greyjoy summer that really was the low point of the game for me. And I can't entirely separate that this was in many ways the beginning of me falling out of love with second edition was this box. I did not enjoy this. You know, the first major event that this box was legal was Thrones War 2019 2019, which I was a regent at. I really appreciate Ryan making me a regent. But the games I played at that tournament were terrible, almost all of them, including the ones I won. And a lot of them had to do with this Greyjoy box. Yeah, and it didn't get better from there. That regional season was also not fun. It was like legitimately just like really just not a fun time for me to play the game. And it had to do a lot with these Greyjoy box cards. And it took a long time, somewhere around close to a year before these Greyjoy Sea of Blood decks were brought under control, basically in time for Worlds 2019. And then, of course, they printed the Bera box shortly thereafter. And
that's a whole nother episode.
Yeah. Are we going to jump into the, what are we going to do next? What is next on our list?
I think King's Landing. We've been sticking with the order they show on Thrones DB so far, I think. So King's Landing cycle is next.
Cool. Yes. That's three more episodes, Will.
Yeah.
Four if we want to include the bin pack. Although I played exactly zero games with this legal. I don't even own this product, so.
I don't know how much we could add to the things we do for love beyond our initial review episode. That it would be pretty much the same.
Yeah. That's the only review episode that Glazer and I did not appear on for, I think, like 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's impressive. Props to you guys for that dedication.
Well, reviewing cards is Aaron's favorite thing to do. So, and I love talking about cards too. So, we'll see you all in the danger zone in 2 weeks.
Indeed.